Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. And now, here are Bob and Richard.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. I'm Bob Venter.
And I'm Richard Munchkin.
Our guest today is two-time world backgammon champion, American Backgammon Hall of Fame inductee, and prolific author of backgammon, chess, and poker books, Bill Roberti. Today we're talking about his new book, How to Play the Opening in Backgammon, Part 1, A New Way of Thinking. Bill Roberti, welcome to Gambling with an Edge.
It's good to be back with you guys. I had a good time a few years ago, and glad to be here.
Good. We'll see if we can repeat that pleasant experience. The new book is part of a three-part series on the openings in backgammon. The new book is entitled A New Way of Thinking. What makes this book and series different from other backgammon books?
Well, what I'm doing in this new book is something that people haven't really thought of doing before, as far as I know, and I've read pretty much everything that's out there. Your typical backgammon book is either a beginner's book, which just is very general and kind of gives you very general ideas about what you're doing. And then there are lots and lots of problem books where the author just gives you a bunch of problems and then explains, his own words, why the right play is the right play. Those have all improved over the years because the bots came along, and now an author doesn't have to worry that he's giving an incorrect solution to one of his own problems. But on the other hand, there's nothing really new introduced there. It's very nice to know that all the problems in the book are correct instead of merely 93% of them. But I got the idea for this a few years ago in the same way I get a lot of my ideas for backgammon books, namely from good chess books. And I was reading a book called An Introduction to Chess Endings by an English player named John Nunn, who I think is the best chess writer out there right now. And what he did was he wrote a book in which on each set of facing pages was a new topic, and he would have four or five positions illustrating the different things that could happen in that kind of endgame. For example, if you're a chess player, you're very familiar with an ending of rook and four pawns against rook and three pawns, and he'd have, two facing pages dealing with just that ending and how it should be played and the kind of issues that came up. Well, I looked at that and I said, gee, that might work as a backgammon book. And that was the sort of the genesis of what I'm doing here, which is to take specific choices that occur all the time in backgammon, in the opening, and then devote two or three pages of the book and maybe five, six, seven, eight positions to explaining how you think about these choices and why you pick one instead of the other. For example, a very basic choice. You're in the opening, you throw a number, and it turns out you can make your own 5-point or you can make your 20-point, an offensive point or a defensive point.
And the 20-point is your opponent's 5-point.
Correct, your opponent's 5-point. So you can make one or the other. And sometimes it's correct to make the 5-point. And sometimes it's correct to make the 20. And what issues, what aspects of the position sort of talk to you and say, no, in this position, it's actually the 5-point you want to make. Or maybe some of them start talking and say, no, in this position, it's really the 20-point you want to make. Now, you couldn't really have written a book like this before the bots, because you need to get a whole bunch of positions where this is the common theme, and you better be darn sure that you've got the right answers. Otherwise, your book is going to be nonsense. But the bots are here now, and they play, something close to perfect backgammon. And so that makes this kind of book possible. You can You can look at a series of positions and you can say, aha, this feature of the position is very important. And, oh, aha, this other feature is also very important. And if you've got a preponderance of features that favor, let's say, making the 5-point, that's probably going to be your right play. But if you've got another preponderance that favor making the 20, well, that's likely to be the right play. So as you step through this book and the two that will follow it shortly, I take one after another, I take these choices that commonly come up, and I try to break them down into which aspects of the position are saying, do play A, and which aspects are saying, do play B. And that's kind of how the whole book and series is laid out.
Now, many openings in backgammon, the players keep hitting each other back and forth, off and off the 5-point or the 4-point on one or both sides. And in this particular
yes.
book, you excluded those positions. Are those going to be covered in part 2 or part 3, or just not going to cover them?
They will not be covered in this series of books, these three volumes. There are two kinds of positions that I excluded. One were the kind you talk about, where many checkers get sent back on each side at the beginning. And what happens when that occurs is sometimes that leads to back games, but sometimes it just leads to these fantastically complicated middle games, which are very different from sort of the run-of-the-mill positions that you see. And they belong in another book. This is just not part of what I would call normal backgammon openings. They're important, but they should be off like as the first part of a book on back games. The other kind of position that didn't make it into the book are blitzes. Because again, a blitz is very different from the sort of positional maneuvering that's happening in most games in the opening. And that too belongs in a book on blitzes. But neither of them, they were such a departure from the way that normal openings are handled and the way that you think about backgammon in the opening in these normal positions, that I just didn't feel, I felt I was going too far astray if I tried to pull those into this book, these three books. So they're for a future time.
So what are the other two going to be in the series? How are they going to?
They are merely, they're covering more topics in addition to the topics that were covered in book one. So, for example, book two, which I'm proofreading now, has a chapter on the 3-point and the 22-point, which are kind of middling points. They're not really important points, but they have their own characteristics. And then a chapter on all the outer board points, the 7, the 18, and the other various outer points, when you make them, when you don't make them, what goes into it. There's a chapter on hitting loose, and there's chapters on the ace point, making your ace point, making your deuce point, that sort of thing. So that's book two. Book three is slotting, splitting. Let's see, what else is in there? Slotting, splitting, one man back, no men back, doubling in the very early part of the game, that sort of stuff.
Okay, so you do have the hitting, you're just not getting into when you both hit each other a couple of times so there are multiple checkers back. But you are going into... Yeah, okay.
Yeah, that's right. Every book has plenty of problems where hitting is one of the choices. You know, you can make the 5-point or you can hit. What do you do? You can make the 20-point or you can hit. What do you do? That sort of thing. But there's not a separate section on hitting, except for the chapter on hitting loose, where your opponent splits to your 4-point or 5-point and you hit him there and stay there and try to make the point. That's a whole chapter in itself, but that's probably the only chapter in the whole series that's solely about hitting.
Now, you use the bot Extreme Gammon called XG, and there's on televised matches they talk about XG, XG Plus, and XG Plus Plus. Presumably, in 4 years, there will be an XG Plus Plus Plus. Do you expect the conclusions of your books to change much as the bots get better?
No. Not this book. They might change if you did a version of XG that played super back games extremely well. It might play better than XG does. But the opening XG is just fine. I do not expect any, I mean, maybe two plays that look like toss-ups right now. Maybe XG plus 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 would say, no, this play is actually clearly a little bit better. But nothing, I don't think the bots are, from this point on, going to change our fundamental understanding of the game. They've already done that once. I mean, the game that we play now doesn't look a whole lot like the game that all the so-called top players played in the 80s and early 90s. The bots did away with that. But I don't expect to see it happen again. Now, I could be wrong, because I never would have believed that the chess program AlphaZero was going to make people like Stockfish and these other programs look like doofuses, but it did. So, you know, the possibility is there. But don't forget, AlphaZero was the first chess program that's a real neural net. All the other chess programs were, you know, modifications of human play plus the ability to calculate 10 or 12 moves into the future. But AlphaZero actually started from scratch and learned the game, just as Jellyfish did and before it TD Gammon did. So AlphaZero is the first chess program that's a true neural net in the sense that all the backgammon programs are. And therefore, I don't think the backgammon programs have much further to go.
And I agree, certainly with the openings, which are, you know, some of the least complicated parts of the game.
Oh, no, they're the most complicated. Believe me.
The openings?
The openings are the hardest part of the game to play well.
Really?
Because here's why. This is very interesting. It took me a while. As I was working on the book, this dawned on me, but I didn't think of it at first. The thing about the opening is that very few of your checkers are actually fixed in position. If you look at the opening position, you only have four checkers that really almost certainly have to stay where they are. The first two checkers on the 6 point and the first two checkers on the 13. The other 11 are all mobile. And so you can have lots more choices in an interesting opening position than you can have, let's say, in prime against prime. Okay, people hold prime against prime up there as sort of, oh, this is a really difficult part of the game. But if you think about it, in a prime against prime game, most of your checkers are fixed in place. They have to be to maintain your prime. And so you're worrying about, well, where do I move the two or three or four checkers that are actually mobile here? That reduces the complexity level enormously. The positions may be hard to solve, but not because they're super complex, because you don't know the answer to the question. But in the opening, everything's mobile. And typically, a non-force play, you might have 3, 4, 5, 6 plausible alternatives. And to my way of thinking, that makes the opening the most complex part of the game.
Huh.
Now, hard to argue with that.
Here's a sense in which, let me add to that one thing. In one sense, it isn't, because in the opening, it's hard to make gross blunders if you're a reasonable player. You'll make lots of errors that in XG's evaluation are 0.03456. Okay, relatively smallish errors. They're still significant, but in these other kinds of games, like priming games, blitzes, back games, you can make huge blunders. because you'll be trying to evaluate two positions that are completely unlike each other, and you're going to be scratching your head a lot. But in terms of what part of the game generates the most errors, even among good players, it's the opening.
Huh, that's surprising to me.
I'm actually going to...
But I understand the logic. Yeah.
I want to introduce a counter-argument, given that
okay.
30 years ago I was an intermediate player, and that's the highest I got, and you've been in the world-class area for 30-some years. So I'm well qualified to argue here. The difference in the openings is that you start every game with the opening. And so if you're limiting the openings to, say, the first five or six moves on each side, yes, there are thousands of combinations and tens of thousands, but you play so many hundreds and thousands of games regularly that you've been through all these. A lot of the priming positions or the back games or the whatever else come about relatively rarely, so you don't have anywhere near the experience with them. Are you going to blow me totally out of the water on that?
I'm going to blow you out a little bit. The openings have been, everybody's played hundreds of thousands of openings. That doesn't mean they have understood them. If you take matches between world-class players and you break the game into 10 subgames, openings, blitzes, holding games, priming games, ace point, deuce point games, back games, races, you know, construct 10 categories that pretty much encompass all the possible positions. And now take a whole bunch of world-class players playing matches and go through and find all the errors and sort them by size of error and type of game. And I've done this. That's where these results are coming from. Here's what happens. The openings will have far and away more errors, even from world-class players, than any of the other parts of the game. They won't have as many blunders. You know, world-class players aren't going to be doing incredibly dumb stuff in the opening. And in other parts of the games, you can have, you know, you can have whoppers, you can have double whoppers with cheese, as McGrill used to call them. You'll have those kinds of errors, but you won't have nearly as many errors, partly because the games don't come up all that often compared to the openings, but partly because a lot of the moves in those sorts of games are pretty easy. There's not a lot going on in a holding game for quite a while. You're not going to make a ton of bad plays. But if you want to combine the frequency of errors with the severity of errors, I think openings, I'm sure openings top the pack. If you are a good player and you want to improve your game and raise it up a notch, the openings are what you want to study first.
Okay.
If I could go off the book for a second,
sure.
You know, when we had Bob Wachtel on, and he was telling us that they now hold tournaments where it doesn't matter if you win the game, the tournament is scored by how many errors you make and the size of those errors. And
correct.
And because of that, people are intentionally making some errors early to avoid complicated positions where they might make more difficult, where the games get more difficult and where they might make bigger errors. I'm just wondering what you think of this format, because to me it sounds kind of crazy.
Come on down, Jim Pascoe. You remember Jim, I assume.
Oh, yes, sure.
Yeah. Jersey
Jim. He's a very great player, and he's a master at creating incredibly complex middle games. He has to make a few errors along the way to do it, at least according to XG. But you can do that. You can, in a sense, you can ruin your opponent's chance at winning one of these tournaments at the cost of ruining your own as well.
Right.
I'm not a fan of these events. I mean, I think competitions are more interesting if you're, if all you really care about is who wins. You know, I don't really care about what somebody's PR was during, you know, a world championship match. The important thing is somebody won and they're, you know, deservedly world champion. So I know the trend you're talking about. It's very real. There are modifications of it where, you know, you somehow take the result of the game and add in the PR scores to get, you know, some sort of, you know, some sort of weighted result. But I would rather play in a tournament where all that matters is did I beat my opponent or did he beat me?
Yeah, me too.
Good.
On that subject, do you play tournaments anymore?
Yeah. Well, interesting. Here's some interesting things. I don't play a lot because I'm writing books, I'm giving lessons, and I just don't take that many trips in the course of a year. Luckily, the last tournament I played was the Boston Open in February, just before the world shut down. But I assume it will open up again, you know, reasonably soon, and then we'll be back, you know, playing backgammon. But here's something very interesting which has happened. This company Zoom, which is one of the real hot tech stocks out there, has actually made it possible to play online backgammon tournaments for serious money without having to worry about whether your opponent's cheating. And that's a major breakthrough. It hasn't really, I think it's just starting to happen that directors are realizing the tool that they have at their disposal and creating online tournaments, which could be extremely popular because you could have
How do they make sure that no one's cheating?
Well, the simplest way, I'm not sure they all do the same thing, but the simplest way is this. Let's say you have a desktop and a laptop computer at your desk, and you're playing in the tournament on your desktop computer. But your laptop computer is sitting to the side, and its camera is taking in a picture of you and your desktop screen. And so as you're playing the match, you can also see your opponent, and you can see what he's looking at. And you can just verify that, well, yes, indeed, he doesn't have XG in another window calling it up to find the right move for him.
Oh, I see. But you're going to need two computers in order to play in the tournament.
That's true. I don't know how much of a problem that is given that how cheap computers are nowadays. But, yeah, ideal setup would be, you know, a desk and then another little desk or table at right angles to it, where the laptop could sit and watch the whole proceedings and send its picture out.
So you still could have somebody out of camera range with XG set up sending signals to you as to how to do it. So, I mean,
well,
there would be ways.
Well, that's getting elaborate.
Really,
yeah, I suppose you could do that too.
If people were playing for, if they were gambling at it, playing for hundreds of dollars or something, a point, people will do all kinds of things to win that.
Well, of course, if your stakes are that high, then you have the money to buy two computers and set them both up and have two little windows on Zoom watching you from every angle.
Yeah.
It's an interesting thought. Good. Let's get back to the book.
Okay.
In several cases, the choice between, we'll say, the 5-point and the 20-point is essentially a tie. And
okay.
you list the factors where if the race is a little bit more this way, you go with this one. If there were more blocks exposed, you would go with this one. And so there are a number of factors. And you kind of, and so you look at these known positions, which are a tie, and then you evaluate the deviations from the known decisions to make your choice, which if you can do that, then now, instead of knowing how to play two or three hands, you know how to play dozens and dozens because you can make the adjustment to the known positions.
Well, that's a way to do it, although I didn't do it quite that way. I didn't start with positions that were toss-ups in my various sections and the various choices. I was trying always to look at positions where there was a definitively correct play. I think a few toss-ups made its way in there just for the sake of interest, but it was not my intent to start with, here's a position where the two choices are equivalent, and now if we deviate from that, we get different answers. You could do it that way. I didn't do it.
But at least once or twice, you said something to the effect of, the student would be well advised to memorize this particular position.
And especially in the chapter on the replies to the opening roll, which I do recommend that people, there's plenty of advice in there on why things are correct, but ultimately you're better off if you just know those by heart.
Okay. Now, XG++ is the bot of choice these days. We've talked about that, and it's inexpensive, and everybody has it.
Correct.
Do you see the fact that a high percentage of players are using the same source to decide what's the correct play on a given hand? Do you think that's a good thing or a bad thing for the game?
I think it's neutral. I don't think it really matters. If someone developed another bot that was sort of equivalent to XG but made marginally different decisions in certain cases, I don't think that would matter very much. It's like I said, I think with XG we're just about at the end of the line here. I don't see any other major changes to backgammon coming along.
But you don't think that'll kill the game?
No. Game's very interesting. It's really hard. I mean,
the game is interesting, but it's no. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I was going to say it's a really hard game. I've sort of had to relearn it because you know I had my sort of initial burst of activity up until like 2002, and then Dan Harrington and I took 10 years off to write the poker books, and then when I came back to backgammon. You know, XG was all the rage. A program called GNU was in there, and I realized, hey, wait a minute, I've fallen way behind the cutting edge right now. I got to relearn how to play this game, and it's hard. It's a hard game. I mean, it's really hard, and I think certainly casual players don't understand that backgammon is not the game they think it is. You know, it's a really difficult game in which a lot of subtle positional ideas impact every move, just as happens in chess. You know, chess players now are playing incredibly hard middle games compared to what chess players did back in Bobby Fischer's day, which was the chess I grew up learning. So I think, backgammon's a really tough game, and there's just an awful lot to learn, an awful lot to know, and I don't think the fact that, you know, the bots kind of have reached something close to their end point is going to have any impact. Plus, it's fun. Yeah.
No, I agree. It's fun, but hasn't popularity waned, and is that partially due, do you think, to the bots, or is that something else?
No, I think, here's roughly how the curve looked. In the 70s, starting in the 60s, going into the 70s, you had this enormous boom. And it kind of reached its peak around 79, 80, 81. And then it started to slope off. And I would say reached its nadir sometime maybe the early 2000s. And since then, it's been slowly on the rise, despite the fact that the bots are better and better. Some of that is new people discovering the game. Some of it is players from the 60s and 70s and 80s coming back to the game now that they're retired from whatever they did. But, you know, the game itself is intrinsically fascinating. I've never lost my taste for it. It's just, yeah, it's terrific. I'm glad I discovered it when I did. I wish I'd discovered it earlier.
The one of the things that made it popular, though, at least when I was playing in the 70s and 80s, was the gambling aspect to it.
Yes.
When Bob Wachtel was on our show a few months ago, he suggested a lot of the gambling is going away because players' PR scores, which is basically how close to perfect they're playing, are published, at least in tournaments. And so if you have a PR score of 4 and I have a PR score of 14, I'm going to know I have no business being in the same game as you. Whereas before, if you were a sufficiently interesting hustler, you could have possibly talked me into a game. Do you find this true?
As far as it goes, that is true. There's lots and lots of high-stakes cash backgammon being played around the country. The players in the – here's what tends to happen. The players in a chouette tend to be closer in ability than players were in the 70s. You're right. In the 70s, you had a situation where everybody thought they knew how to play, and everybody thought their way of playing was better than some other Joe's way of playing if he didn't play the way they did. And that made for very lively chouettes with players of widely different abilities. And that you don't see anymore. But there's still plenty of backgammon being played. And, you know, hey, I mean, if I'm in a game and somebody comes in and their, you know, PR is 5, or excuse me, if their PR is 3 or 2, I'm not going to drop out of the game just because they got in, even if they have a slight edge. And a chouette, you know, you don't have to be the best player to be a winner. So my own personal observation is that the death of money backgammon is overblown.
Oh, well, that's good to hear. That's encouraging.
Yes. I'm glad, because I really liked playing chouettes back in the 70s and the 80s. And they've at tournaments, you don't see as much chouette action. You know, it used to be you'd go to a tournament, and Saturday night the rounds would all be finished, and everybody'd be chouetting. And that was great. And that you don't see much of anymore. There might be a chouette for, you know, quarters or 20s off in the corner somewhere, but what has replaced it in tournaments is a deluge of all sorts of specialized events, you know, seniors, juniors, doubles, you know, this jackpot, that jackpot, some other jackpot. The directors have, you know, realized that, hey, why should I just run one big tournament and take one cut when I can run 20 tournaments over the same weekend and take 20 cuts?
Right.
That sounds like a pretty smart tournament director. And with that, we're going to take a break for commercials. We'll be right back with Bill Roberti. And we have some more questions for him. The South Point has more than 10,000 games, returning more than 99%. This is more than anyone else has, and that probably should be a caveat. They had more than 10,000 games on March 11th, and now they're basically opening up every other machine. So they probably have 6,000 games, because on a bank of 3 machines, they would have 2 games open and not 1.5. But that's still more than anybody else has. There will not be video poker classes at the South Point this fall. There normally are, but given the uncertainty of the coronavirus, decided to postpone them. At the promotion for June is Free Play with the Kicker. If you get a mailer in March or June, every Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, you can pick up Free Play. And if you do, you will pick up the same amount. You can pick up the same amount on Friday or Saturday. If you make all 8 pickups, or in June is actually be 7 pickups, because the casino was closed on the first Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday of the month, then you'll be able to have a double pickup on either September 29th or 30th. Predicted.org is a market where you can place small bets on the occurrence of various political events, mostly but not entirely in the United States. Gambling with an Edge listeners receive a one-time offer of a deposit match up to $20 at predicted.org/promo/edge. You must play the money through once and cannot withdraw it for 30 days. BlackjackApprenticeship.com is an excellent site for those of you who wish to be successful at counting cards at blackjack. Column Jones regularly produces a number of YouTube videos that are free to everybody, and they go on YouTube and they stay there. He produces others that go behind a paywall. But among the ones that are free for everybody, recently there was one on how much should you tip, if at all, and one about maybe 6 months old were the best five blackjack books in his opinion. They have periodic boot camps where the whole weekend is spent towards you learning how to count cards better than when you came in. If you were good to start with, you will be better. And you practice, you get tested. And one of the nice things about the boot camp is there are a number of working pros who show up to support the boot camp. And there's all kinds of questions you can ask them. And it's a very useful place to craft your skill. VideoPoker.com is the best place to play lots of games. If you sign up for the Gold membership, $8.95 a month or $79.95 a year, this allows you to get correction on most of the game. The game of the week is Wheel Poker with Quick Quads. 7 coins per line, which is 1 extra coin for the wheel and 1 extra coin for the quick quads. Wheel spin averages 157.5 coins, and you can get it for every quad and every quick quad. The double-double bonus version at the South Point returns some 99.8% before the slot club, and it's available for triple play and five play quarters. All right, we are back with Bill Roberti talking about his new book on how to play the opening in backgammon. Now, I'm a video poker writer, and just the fact that I'm forced to come up with something new every week forces me to be up on my game, and I'm sure I'm a better player for it. Now, you're both a writer and a publisher of books by top-level players. Have you found this regimen of writing and publishing an asset to your own abilities?
Oh, absolutely. I can say quite confidently that no one will learn more from my new books than I did writing them. Because writing forces you to, you really have to understand the position so well you can explain it to another person. That's another level of sort of comprehension beyond just being able to look at a position and say, I think play X is right. In order to explain it properly, you got to really think, okay, does this explanation hold up? Is this really what's happening? Can I, if my explanation is correct, then I should be able to find some corollary positions that are very similar, but there's a subtle change in them that makes the correct play here, the wrong play over there. Can I find one of those to mix in as another, another example? There's a huge amount of work that goes into writing it, and that work is extremely beneficial to becoming a better player.
Are you also, so you also publish books by other top players? Do you do
mostly
editing
Kit
of their book?
Kit Woolsey's the main other top player that writes for the Gammon Press, yeah.
Do you edit his stuff, or is it pretty well ready to go when he gives it to you?
I do very minor edits. Just really looking for, a typo, this or that. I'm not rewriting them in any sense. Kit's a fine writer. He doesn't need rewrites.
Doesn't need rewrites, but everyone can use an extra set of competent eyes on what they put out there.
It's incredible how many times you can read a book, and you know, once it's all done and printed, you look at it, and over time you will find, you know, many more errors. There, fortunately, I try to print my books in somewhat small batches so that, you know, any errors that were found in the first printing can be fixed in the second.
Now, your early books were some 40 years ago, maybe Lee Ganoud versus Joe Dweck, which was on a final of the World Championship.
Yes.
Presumably, your comments at that point were pre-bought. And do you ever go back and look at how well your analysis of that holds up 40 years later? Or it's just like, that was a good book for the time, I'm moved on beyond that now?
Yeah, I'd be scared to go back and look at it. Yeah, it was a good book for the time. I will totally agree with that. It would need a complete rewrite. And, you know, you were talking about players. Don't forget, a world-class player, then, you know, they had PRs between 8 and 12. They'd be... You know, some of them would be not even open-level players today. So, you know, it was interesting for its time. I'll say that and no more.
Okay.
Well, that was an interesting match to capture also, just because, you know, there was a lot of discussion that Joe Dweck threw that match.
I reject that. Based on two things, based on my analysis, you know, he was playing the way people played then, as was Lee. Lee had the benefit of realizing that to beat Joe, she would have to play very aggressively, and she did. And that was the perfect tonic for a world-class player at that time. Just be more aggressive. And she was, and she ended up picking up, you know, like 10 free points by doubling the amount of positions that, you know, a modern player would look at and say, you'd have to be insane to drop this double. How can you drop this? This is so clear. But she got a lot of free games, and eventually he couldn't make up that difference. In addition, I knew someone who was with Joe and Lewis the night before the match, and she told me that there was no question that Joe wanted to win, and, you know, he was nervous that he might not, but he wanted to win that match.
On YouTube matches, some of the recent ones have been raving about an endgame book by probably the second most famous Japanese player named Michi.
Michi, yes.
It's not Gammon Press, but would you rave about that book? Is it good?
It's a good book. It's sort of the basics. If you're a beginner or an intermediate, this is telling you about all the basic ending situations that come up and what to do. And in that sense, it's an excellent book. If I had an intermediate player as a pupil, I would say, look, you should go out, first of all, read that book and read his opening book. They're both written for you, and you will profit from it.
When you're talking about endings, are you talking about bear-off positions?
No. My definition of an ending is a backgammon ending is any sort of commonly occurring, you know, very little contact, but some contact left, or maybe no contact, and there's tactics involved that are non-obvious. For example, you were playing a holding game, your opponent got all his checkers by you, he's bearing them off, you're bringing checkers around the board, and you have to place them so that over the next two or three moves, you have the best chance of getting off the gammon. All right, there's a typical ending. It occurs all the time. It's quite subtle. There are many plays here that look obvious and they're wrong. Playing that ending well, or perfectly, as most players would want to do, is actually quite difficult. There's a lot of subtle little tactics involved. So that would be one example. Endings where there's a minimal amount of contact, but still some contact. You have to decide, do I leave a shot or do I don't leave a shot? But not pure races and bear-offs. That I would put in a different category.
But an ace-point game, for example, or...
No, an ace-point game, well, yeah. How to bear off against an ace-point game, that you would consider, I think, one of the endings I'm talking about. Occurs commonly, lots of subtleties to it, not really much to learn except... how to bear off properly, and then if you hit a shot, how to contain it. Containment would be another big category of endings, where you've hit a shot, you've got a sort of a prime, but the prime's not finished, and how much risk do you take in order to contain that checker you just hit? There's another good, typical ending example.
Yeah. Now, you're finishing your opening series. So let's say you're done with those in a year. I just made that number up. I don't know how long.
Less than that. They're all written. Right now I'm proofreading volume 2, and I figure I have to typeset it. So that should be out by maybe early August. And book 3 will be the same process. Proofread, typeset. Do all the diagrams, and then that should be before the end of the year.
Have you decided what's your next project?
Yeah, take 6 months off and relax. I've been working on this for 4 years.
Well, that's what the coronavirus is all about.
Well, yeah, for me, I hate to say this because a lot of people have really been put through the ringer, but for me, it made almost no difference in my daily life at all. I sit up here in my office and work on the book, and every now and then my wife and I will call out for takeout. But, we're the benefits of two people working at home is manifold in this situation.
So what kind of things can one find at the website, thegammonpress.com?
You can order books there, and I've got a blog which, is never ending, so every couple of weeks I put up a new blog post on some interesting position or a series of positions that grab my attention. There's some commentary on backgammon history and how backgammon relates to other games, and unfortunately the occasional obituary, because a lot of the heroic figures of the 60s and 70s are passing away now, so... Just a general, discussion about backgammon issues.
Very good. We thank you for your visit.
Okay.
I think we'd like to, when you finish volumes 2 and 3, we'd probably want to discuss them in one chat rather than two chats. But
okay.
If that is agreeable to you, the door is open and we'd welcome you back.
Okay, absolutely.
Now, at this point of the show, Richard and I normally give on what we call a recommended section. I'm going to lead off and recommend a book by an author who I enjoy considerably more than Richard does. This author is named Malcolm Gladwell, and I've been reading his book, Talking to Strangers, and find it fascinating and educational. It's about basically making decisions when you're evaluating somebody else and how judges do it and some famous cases as to people get it wrong and why. So I'm finding that interesting. So, Richard, do you have a recommendation? I'm assuming you're not recommending Malcolm Gladwell.
I haven't read that particular book. So, but no, I am reading right now. It's an older book. It's called Devil in the White City by Eric Larson. And it is the story of the Columbian Exposition in Chicago back in 1893. And it's about the building of that. And at the same time, there's a parallel story about a serial killer who was living and operating there in Chicago at the same time. And it's really an interesting book. So that's what I am enjoying right now, and I would recommend it, Devil in the White City by Eric Larson.
How did you happen to find that? That sounds – I have not heard of that book. I've
You know, I had been aware of it for, 10 or more years, and I read something else by Eric Larson, and I just ran across it, and I was like, you know, I've always been meaning to read this, so I picked it up.
So. Very good.
And Bill, what about you? Do you have a Yeah,
I'm going to go lowbrow on you guys. I'm currently reading a book called Nine Dragons by Michael Connelly, which is, I think, the 10th or 11th book in his Harry Bosch series of mysteries. And I've always been a big fan of that. And about every 8 or 10 years or so, I start at volume one and reread them, because by then I've forgotten the plot, the characters, and what happened. So it all becomes new again.
I am also a big fan of those books, the Harry Bosch books, and also the television show on Amazon Prime, Bosch.
I have not seen that. I've heard of it, and I saw a picture of the actor they hired to play Harry Bosch, and I think they hit it right on the nail on the head.
Yeah. Yeah. Good
so
show.
Connelly has, I mean, Bosch is one of his two major characters, but he has this, the Cadillac lawyer, who is,
the Lincoln lawyer.
The Lincoln lawyer, who is a cousin or something of Bosch's. Do you read those two, or do you stick to the Bosch ones?
No, I read them both. First of all, Harry Bosch is in a lot of the Lincoln lawyer books.
Yes.
I forget the name of the lawyer offhand. What was
Mickey,
his name?
Mickey Haller?
Yeah,
Mickey Haller.
Yeah.
Yeah, Mickey Haller, right. So Bosch pops up. Yeah, they're vaguely related. They're like half-brothers or something. So that makes it interesting. And those are very good, too. Now, I have heard, looking at Amazon reviews and stuff, that the last couple of Connelly books, which I have not read, aren't up to snuff anymore. It's like they're ghostwritten or something, that they're just not that good. But certainly there's like 30 books in the series that are terrific. So I would wholeheartedly recommend them to anybody who likes, you know, crime, mysteries, that sort of thing.
And actually, those are all set in Los Angeles, and a similar series set 400 miles north of there is by John Lescroart, who does he has his 30 or 40 books where one of his characters is a police detective and one of them is a defense lawyer and one of them is and there's interlapping stories, but it's if you like one of the series, you will probably like the other, and probably conversely, if you hate one, you'll probably hate the other. I'm not sure. I happen to like them both.
There is another series actually set in Boston. The original author was named Robert Parker, and his character was Spencer, and they are also excellent reading, in a slightly different vein, a little less attention to the police procedural, a little more attention to the psychological side of things.
Very good.
Yes.
This has been fun. Thank you very much for joining us, Bill.
My pleasure again, and look forward to episode 3 coming in a few months.
Perfect. Thank you, Richard. Go out and hit lots of royal flushes, everybody. Good day.